From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Response was immediate to Donald Trump's tweeted announcement this morning promising a major investigation into voter fraud. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State John Husted tweeted out, "We already have a statewide review and it's easy to vote, hard to cheat." But the president claims that 3 to 5 million unauthorized immigrants did cheat voting in the election. In a press briefing yesterday, his spokesman, Sean Spicer, said Trump believes what he believes based on the information he was provided, citing a 2008 study. But, and stay with us here, fact-checkers are pointing out that Spicer is confusing two studies, one from Pew Research in 2008, one from Old Dominion, and the Old Dominion is flawed. Phew. Brian Schaffner is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And Brian, you collected the data that Old Dominion University used in that study in 2014. They concluded that 14% of non-citizens said they were eligible to vote. Now, that doesn't mean they voted, but you say, besides that, Old Dominion got your data wrong?
That's right. So we put out this large-scale survey, and essentially what the authors did was they downloaded the survey data that we put out, and then they looked at this question that we asked that sort of comes at the end of a very long questionnaire, which includes an option where people can select that they are an immigrant non-citizen. And a very small percentage of people clicked that button. And so they looked at those people who were, said that they were immigrant non-citizens and then looked to see how many were matched to voter rolls. And they found 14% were. The problem is that some people just click the wrong button. This is an online survey. Some people actually ended up, after 20 minutes of answering questions, they just accidentally clicked that button. And the way we know this is we went back and re-interviewed these people 2 years later and essentially found that a lot of people changed their answer. They actually were citizens. In fact, some people who said that they were citizens in the first wave actually ended up saying they were non-citizens in the next wave, which is impossible. And essentially, the people who we could confirm were in fact non-citizens, there was not a single voter among that group.
Say that again. There is, instead of 14% being non-citizen immigrants who then were on voter rolls, you're saying there were none.
That's right. That's right. There's of the people we could be sure were in fact non-citizens, not a single person voted.
Okay. Now, there was also a 2008 study that was cited by Sean Spicer. It was done by Pew Research. It was released in 2012, based in part on 2008 election results. It examined outdated or inaccurate voter registration records. Now, not about potential illegal voting by non-citizens. The author of that Pew study said his report never found any fraud. He says voting integrity in 2016 was better in this election than ever before. But we're hearing the Trump administration say that the study shows things like, you know, dead people on registration rolls. Why is that?
Well, that's, of course, that's going to happen because people die and the records aren't immediately updated. And so it takes some time for a state board of elections to actually find the people who have moved, to find the people who are dead. But they have procedures for doing this. And that study basically pointed out that actually they're actually quite good at doing this. And the other thing to note, there's an incredible amount of transparency on these voter files. Any public citizen can get a voter file and look at it. Essentially, scholars look at these things all the time, and we don't find any evidence of fraud.
Well, look, this seems to all be pointing to what we're hearing a lot about in this election cycle, which is that partisans, all partisans, see and hear what they want to see and hear. And you just did a study, and people can see it today. It was in today's Washington Post, coincidentally.
Yes.
Taking those two pictures of the inauguration, we've all seen them with the crowds in 2009, Barack Obama's, and the crowds last Friday. You asked people to look at those pictures side by side, including Trump supporters. Now, you had some expectation what they might say. Even you were surprised. What happened?
For half the people, we just asked which picture goes with which inauguration. And we found that 40% of Trump voters said that the Obama crowd was actually the Trump crowd, compared to only, I think, 8% of
so they thought the larger crowd.
Right, the larger crowd was the Trump crowd. But here's the one that was really interesting. For the other half of the sample, all we did was we showed them the two pictures, and all we asked was which photograph has more people in it.
And I just want to jump in. Just to describe the pictures, the 2009 President Obama crowd stretches from the Capitol, fills the entire mall all the way back.
That's right.
The Donald Trump crowd for whatever reason, does not. I mean, I was standing in the middle in a very empty space. You know, there were thousands of people there, but there are huge empty swaths. So you asked people to look at both these pictures.
All we said was, which photo has more people in it? And 15% of people who voted for Trump actually said the photograph from Trump's inaugural with fewer people in it actually had more people in it. It's actually a something that we call expressive responding, where people answer a question, but they are actually answering a different question. So, for example, we see this a lot with questions about the economy. When we ask people how the economy is doing, if your president is in power, you're more likely to say the economy is doing great.
Look, you're the political scientist. Do you welcome an investigation into the elections? Maybe we'll put the questions to rest for once and for all. Or do you think it might become politicized and tainted if it's not independent?
I would worry about a Trump administration conducting a investigation into voter fraud. I think it's clear that they have already have a conclusion that they want to confirm. I'm very confident there is no widespread fraud out there.
Brian Schaffner, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Brian, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, the Trump administration has told some federal departments, including the Environmental Protection Agency, to stop publishing press releases, blog updates, and social media posts. The administration says it's just a temporary suspension pending reviews. But the ban concerns critics who fear the administration will censor politically divisive topics. Soon after Trump became president, the White House website was updated, and among the changes, all information on climate change disappeared. So researchers are rushing to copy and preserve key data, as Susan Phillips of Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
Imagine yourself a high school science teacher needing the most updated teaching tool for a lesson on climate change. You click on the EPA's link for climate change lesson plans, and it says, quote, page not found. Or you're a parent of small children with asthma, and you're moving to a new town, and you want to know air quality data for different neighborhoods. Again, page not found. These are examples of what people like Michelle Murphy fear will disappear under the Trump administration.
So all those questions are kind of wrapped up together. So it should matter because it's what you breathe and what you drink.
Murphy is an expert in technology science from the University of Toronto. She flew all the way to Philadelphia on a recent weekend to participate in the University of Pennsylvania's Data Refuge Hackathon. She also helped organize a similar hackathon in Toronto. Digital archivists know that with every new administration, government-held information disappears. Sometimes it's just a matter of budget priorities. Funds no longer exist to keep up a website. Other times, it's for political reasons. Murphy says she did research on the loss of EPA data under the Reagan administration, which led to agency staffers unionizing.
And so there's a long history of these kinds of struggles in these agencies trying to defend scientific integrity and evidence-based research.
And data is not just threatened by Republican administrations. The data preservation organization Internet Archive, in cooperation with the federal government's own publishing office, preserved more than 3,000 items from the George W. Bush administration before Obama took office. Whether or not Murphy's worst fears will come to pass, she says there is already a problem with preserving online data. Penn librarian Laurie Allen agrees.
The Internet is a terribly unstable way to keep information available. I don't remember the statistic, but a huge number of references to websites no longer work. And so this has been a problem.
Speaking from the top floor of Penn's library, Allen was surrounded by about 100 people, archivists, librarians, tech workers, and students, all hunched over computers, writing on whiteboards, and racing to preserve climate data from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration and the Department of Energy.
Okay, wait, can we just go back for a sec? So the metadata.json from my harvesting documentation? Because I have something from, is that right?
Allen helped organize the Data Refuge Hackathon at Penn. She says the cost of hosting all this data on private servers could run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Right now, the Data Refuge organizers are dependent on an anonymous donor. The idea is that the information remains available to the public. And as a librarian, Allen says she wants to make sure the information is stored properly.
So the datarefuge.org site right now is the holding area for these bags of files that we're getting from federal websites.
Kevin Burke is a volunteer and grad student studying anthropology at Penn. He says his tech skills are pretty minimal, and he likely won't use any of this data in his research. But he sees the effort as a potential love letter to the future.
When you're a historian and you're working in an archive, sometimes you pull out a folder and you just think, oh man, the foresight that somebody had to stick that in a folder and save that for me. And so now I can pull it out and make sense of something. I mean, I think that's really powerful.
By the end of the weekend, the volunteer hackers downloaded 1.5 terabytes of data. Their next stop will be Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then New York City. For Here and Now, I'm Susan Phillips.
And 2017 is going to be the end of an era in air travel. Both United and Delta Airlines are retiring Boeing 747s from their fleets this year, which means there will be no more North American passenger airlines operating the 747, also known as the Queen of the Skies. It's been in operation since 1970. Joining us now via Skype is Clive Irving, who is the aviation correspondent for the Daily Beast and author of the book Wide Body, The Triumph of the 747. Clive, welcome back.
It's nice to be here.
So why are these airlines retiring their 747s?
Well, it's 47 years since United's retiring theirs at the end of this year. It's 47 years it's been flying, which is a long, long time for an airplane. And this all goes down to one thing, that when an airline looks at an airplane now, when they look at buying a new airplane, they're not actually looking at an airplane. They're looking at a business plan, business model, actually. They want the most efficient combination of several things. They want a set number of passengers to go a set distance. And that's a fairly demanding equation these days. So basically, Boeing have been very smart, and they've made their own plane obsolescent, if not obsolete, by producing a version of the slightly smaller 777, the Boeing 777, that's far more fuel efficient over virtually the same distances as a 747, carries slightly fewer people. The 777 being a much more modern plane, therefore it's much more fuel efficient. So the numbers make a lot of sense.
So it's a more fuel efficient plane. Could they have made a new version, though, of the 747 that would be more fuel efficient and still have that little, iconic second floor hump in the front of the plane?
Yeah, isn't that a wonderful part of the character? Yeah. The plane has a very identifiable and recognizable profile. Well, they did actually make a later version called the 747-8, which was produced 5 or 6 years ago. They hoped that they could compete with their own 777, and it turned out that they couldn't. So that latest version of the 747 is going to end up as a cargo carrier, basically. That's what it's being sold as, and not as a passenger plane. It's all about size. You've got three sizes of planes. You've got the 777 and the Airbus A350, which are long-haul planes carrying around 400 people, going up to, say, 6,000 or 7,000 miles in distance. Then below them, you've got another category, which is by far the largest category, which is the single aisle, because the ones I've just mentioned are all wide bodies. You go down to 185 to 200 people, which is split between Airbus with the A320 and 321 and Boeing with the 737. And I'll tell you something fascinating about the 737 in a minute. And then below that, you've got a category which Boeing and Airbus, which is basically a duopoly, planes with 108 to 130 seats. Now, the fascinating thing about the 737, which is the largest money spinner Boeing has ever made, was it was designed by the same people at the same time as the 747 in the late 1960s. And it turned out to be an amazing cash cow. They keep adapting it, making it slightly larger, putting more efficient engines on it. So you've got a contrast between one plane, which is the 747, which is absolutely a game changer in long-haul international flying, and another one which is sort of much more modest and unsung, which is in fact Boeing's biggest money spinner. Hmm.
Well, you also have the 747 as the plane for Air Force One. This is the plane that the president flies on. What was so special about it that it became the gold standard, at least for the president of the United States?
Well, it became the gold standard for everybody, really, in terms of safety and comfort. It's not exaggerating to say that the 747 transformed the whole idea of flying around the world, because when it was introduced, it was a third more fuel efficient than what had gone before it. And it was the first plane really to democratize. It introduced something entirely new to the human experience, which was the economic availability of international air travel to large numbers of people. So in that sense, it's been an enormous force for good, for people experiencing other countries and other cultures. It was a machine for doing that. And it can't be overestimated the effect that that plane had. And then, as you said, it was a kind of, almost had a personality of its own when it nosed towards the airport gate and you saw that great bulbous upper deck there. Actually, obviously I've written a book about it, so I know it quite intimately. I still feel when I go aboard it that it's very special. There's nothing else quite like it. Airbus tried to get into this market with the Super Jumbo, the A380, which is larger than a 747.
And has a second floor that goes all the way from the front to the back.
That's right, yes. But that's the sort of category that Boeing agonized greatly over whether they should come ahead and produce a competitor to that, a new, larger version of the 747, and quite wisely decided not to, because that's a very limited category. 544 passengers flying between hubs, basically, between city hubs. The others are much more adaptable, much more flexible. They're not confined between capital cities anymore. They fly what's called point-to-point, which is any major city in any country. For example, one of the longest flights that's now going to be possible is Boston to Shanghai on an Airbus A350. That's a pretty long flight for a nonstop, about 16 or 17 hours. A 747 could never get near those numbers.
Well, and we heard from the United Airlines president, Scott Kirby, that the airline plans a retirement celebration for the 747. We should say that in other countries, you actually see a lot of 747s, and probably in other parts of the world, we still will for some time.
Yeah, I think until about 2020, British Airways is still flying them across the Atlantic because they've amortized the cost of them. So it's quite economic for them to do that. They use them as a kind of bus shuttle across the pond. And you will, throughout Europe and Asia, you'll still see them. But they will, because no airline can afford to persist flying a plane that's not as economical to operate as the newer planes are. There aren't any sentimental reasons for keep flying a 747. It's just that the people who still have them want to get the maximum use out of them before they get rid of them.
What's going to be the thing you'll miss most about the 747?
Ah, that's a very good question. I think just the feel of its personality. It's so rock solid and stable. When it comes into land, for example, it looks as though it's flying about 50 miles an hour because it's so big, it's actually flying 150 miles an hour. And I just think there are very few machines these days, cars or planes, that you can develop a personal attachment to. And I still think it's possible to do that with the 747.
That's Clive Irving, aviation correspondent for the Daily Beast and author of the book Wide Body, The Triumph of the 747. Clive, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, Serena Williams is soaring. She's reached the semifinals at the Australian Open, finishing off the UK's Johanna Konta today with a hard serve up the middle.
Strong stuff from Serena at the finish.
And with Serena's win, there are some interesting statistics. She makes it three American women in the semis, including her sister Venus and Coco Vandeweghe. That's the first time that's happened at a Grand Slam since 2002. And there are also now three women over 30 in the semifinals, 36-year-old Venus, 35-year-old Serena, and 34-year-old Mirjana Lucic-Baroni. Pam Shriver has thoughts. She, of course, the International Tennis Hall of Fame member and ESPN commentator who knows from which she speaks. Pam, how unusual is this for American women?
Well, so unusual. It's been well over 10 years since it's happened. No surprise that the Williams sisters are two of the three. I mean, they have been the mainstay for American women's tennis for 20 years. And then you throw in also Coco Vandeweghe with her tremendous athletic background, and then, frankly, a Cinderella story with Lucic Baroni back at a major for the first time in almost 20 years, and she has had at times a tragic, sad story as her father's abuse took toll on her career and her really affected her life in a horrible way. But now she is back, and it's really a fantastic lineup of semifinalists.
Well, and talk about the age aspect, because as Serena says, no matter what happens, someone 34 or older is going to be in the final, and that's just great.
Well, this has been the growing trend the last few years as players have managed their careers for longevity, and it makes sense from a financial standpoint. They figured out how, with the help of physical trainers and better nutrition, and you put all that in, I think Roger Federer and Venus have been the best examples that, you know, you can just make this career high quality well into the mid-30s, and now we'll see who can push it towards 40. I mean, it is possible. As Ken Rosewall showed about 25, 30 years ago, you can do it.
Yeah. Well, but talk about the men. Why is it that American men are so underrepresented, you know, in the final stretch of these competitions? What's going on?
I think a lot of us feel that there's other cultures in the world where tennis is not only more important in that country, but also maybe the culture shows a little more tough love when they train their young athletes. Is it possible here in the United States that our young people are just coddled a little bit too much versus Spain's one example? Their last 15 years has been really incredible. Nadal's led the way. I mean, there's nobody tougher than Nadal.
Hmm. That's a little smack down there from Pam Shriver.
Well, just my truth.
Yeah. Pam Shriver, ESPN commentator, 2002 inductee into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Of course, you know, just a terrific player herself. Who do you think? Serena Williams facing Lucic Baroni, Venus taking on Coco Vanderwey. Who do you think?
Well, I picked Serena before the tournament. Certainly not going to bail now. But I think Coco-Venus semifinal could be really fascinating. I'd be surprised if Serena isn't meeting one of them. Serena will be in the finals.
Can't wait. Pam, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Have a great one.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Moments after this morning's opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrial Average crossed the 20,000 mark for the first time ever. Joining us now from New York is Maggie Lake, host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy. We finally got there.
We should remind people the stock market is not the economy, but what's the significance of this?
You know, a lot of people will sort of say, oh, they're just big round numbers, but I like to think of them as good road markers to where we are and where we're going. And this one is signaling really a newfound confidence that we have a new president that's serious about trying to grow the economy, reduce regulation, cut corporate taxes, and really sit down face-to-face with business leaders. We saw that earlier in the week. Now, they have reservations. Investors and traders have reservations about him, absolutely, in this administration. But for now, they're giving President Trump the benefit of the doubt.
And it's been bouncing right around 20,000 for some time now. Is there a reason it happened today?
Yeah, and I think a couple things happened this week. Traders, because I asked a bunch of traders this today, and they said, listen, he came out swinging right at the beginning of the week, and it seems like he's really going to try to move quickly to try to execute his agenda. And that's why we saw infrastructure stocks like Caterpillar, big winner today, up 2%. We'll see if it closes. Goldman Sachs, financials benefiting from regulations. Those continued themes are pushing. But this is also about earnings. We've seen the earnings picture improving. It started last week, continuing through that profit picture, that improving profit picture, is something Donald Trump's inheriting. It's going to be a tailwind for us, and that is combined what helped lift us over today.
Now, the Dow has risen 1,600 points since Trump was elected, but there were fears that there was going to be a crash if he won. And in fact, I remember the night of the election, for a little while there, the Dow futures were down hundreds of points. And then all of a sudden, it turned around and things started getting better in the stock market. But what happened?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of my guests said, the thing I'm going to do, my New Year's resolution, is not underestimate Donald Trump. And I think that investors have made a decision to pay attention to what he's doing and not so much about what he's saying. That's not easy. And there are some things that they're very uncomfortable with. They don't like talk of a trade war. That's really concerning to them. They don't like the tweeting. They don't like the volatility. There are a lot of questions. Can he get Republicans to actually puts his agenda into legislation? Can he work with them? That's a big question. And there's another one I think we need to pay attention to, Jeremy, and that is, can Donald Trump, okay, profits are up, corporations are doing well. Can he pull Main Street in to benefit from that? The thing that caught him into the office is that people felt like they weren't benefiting from globalization, from an improving economy. Can Donald Trump bridge those two worlds? Or are corporations just going to take all this profits, this big rally, give it back to shareholders with dividends and buybacks? Those are big open questions. I think investors were thinking a lot about them in the run-up to the election. Post-election, they've been concentrating more on some of these policies and these promises that are so pro-business, but that could change. So we got over 20,000 today. Doesn't mean we're going to stay there.
Well, and when you look back, as people did today, the Dow hit 100 in 1906. It hit 1,000 in 1966. It hit 10,000 in 1999 during the dot-com boom. And now here we are today in 2017 with the Dow Jones Industrial hitting 20,000. We'll see if it stays there. Maggie Lake, host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's time now for a jazz edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Bo Leibowitz is a jazz DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. He joins us now. Hi, Bo.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And you've got some new releases or new re-releases for us. And let's start with something from Dizzy Gillespie and Friends. This is Blue and Boogie. What can you tell us about this one?
Well, first of all, that was the great late James Moody, who was wailing away there on the tenor saxophone. But this is a sextet that was put together. This goes back to 1980. It was a concert in Montreal. And unfortunately, none of these people are with us today, but it certainly was an all-star sextet, including Milt Jackson on vibes and Dizzy, of course, on trumpet. Hank Jones on piano, Philly Joe Jones on drums, and Ray Brown on bass. And the tune they're doing there is called Blue and Boogie, which was a bebop anthem written by Dizzy Gillespie. And this is just about as straight ahead as you can get.
Well, and given the fact that none of them is still alive, why does something like this get re-released?
Well, I think this was kind of a strange incident because the producer of the concert released a recording of this and on a private label, I believe, and it only lasted for a few months and was withdrawn, and therefore it's almost like a new release. And it's just the fact that it's such a stellar sextet that makes it important. Plus, the playing is just great all the way around, especially Milt Jackson on vibes is particularly good on this recording.
All right, well, up next we have the pianist George Cables. This is off his new CD. It's called For Honeylulu. What do you like about this one?
Well, for one thing, I like the bass line, actually, is what attracted me to this particular track. It's just very catchy, and I like the way that you barely notice it, but there's a tenor saxophone who shadows the singer on the cut that we heard, which is not Honey Boo Boo, but it's Honey Lulu, For Honey Lulu.
Yeah.
And also the fact that George Cables, who's been around since the 70s and 80s and is played with everybody from Art Blakey to Joe Henderson, Sonny Rollins, and especially Art Pepper. He just sounds great on this, and it's all his original compositions. Therefore, the disc is called the George Cables Songbook. The singer, by the way, I've never heard of her before. Her name is Sarah Elizabeth Charles.
Beautiful voice.
And yes, and she wrote the lyrics to a majority of the tunes, which are vocals on this particular recording.
People should not be fooled. Your peace of mind is come and go.
All right, well, next, you wanted us to hear Swingin' the Blues by the Count Basie Orchestra featuring Lester Young. Now, this is from a newly released recording that is now available on Apple Music, but when was it actually recorded?
It was recorded. They are radio broadcasts from between 1938 and 1940 of the Basie Band, which was then at its height in terms of dynamically just the machine that wouldn't stop. I mean, it was a fabulous band and featured Lester Young, as these recordings do. It was put together by an engineer, a young man by the name of William Savory, and therefore it's called the Savory Collection. This material has been aware of by jazz aficionados for many years, but it's now finally seeing the light of day, and they are extended versions of things that were put out by the Decca label, some very famous sides from the late 30s of the Count Basie Orchestra featuring Lester Young and Harry Sweets Edison and Buck Clayton and Buddy Tate. And Swingin' the Blues is builds up in momentum and goes out on a riff that features Papa Joe Jones on drums. And it's just, it's the highlight of many highlights in this particular collection.
You know, one of the things I notice when I hear music like this from the 30s, from the 40s, is it sounds like it's got almost a different energy to it than some of the more modern jazz that we hear. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, I think the bands played for dancers, and there was a lot of energy involved in that. Later on, when bebop flourished, say, in the early to mid-40s, the music changed a bit, especially with Charlie Parker, and people would actually sit down and listen to the music rather than dance to it. So it became more of an intellectual thing rather than a pulsating type music.
Interesting. All right, well, we have time for one more. This is Jimmy Scott and The Nearness of You with Joe Pesci.
And the feel in the The nearness of you. It's not the pale moon that excites me, that thrills and delights me. No, no, no.
So we're talking Joe Pesci as in My Cousin Vinny right there.
That's right. And this one just absolutely threw me for a loop when I first heard it because, first of all, the man can actually sing quite well. And I understand he plays guitar, too. And he sings in a style that is very similar to Jimmy Scott, who was one of the great ballad singers of all time. This was his last recording. It was recorded in 2009, and Jimmy died in 2014. But Joe Pesci had always been a fan. And this recording also features other people like Dee Dee Bridgewater on it in duet with Jimmy, who his voice is failing a little bit. He's 84 when he made this recording, but the spirit is still there. The phrasing is still there. It's just all Jimmy Scott. And Joe Pesci is a revelation.
Have you ever heard any other stuff that he's done as a musician?
Never, never. From what I understand, he was just a fan. He used to go visit Jimmy Scott at various clubs in New York, and they became friends. And this is the first time that I know of him on record, and he sounds wonderful.
How's the world of jazz right now?
Well, you know, everybody, I'm thinking in terms of, say, La La Land, the movie, where one of the motifs was that, oh, jazz is dying, jazz is dead. They've been saying that for 100 years. It's never going to die. It's a niche audience, perhaps, but it's the foundation of a lot of modern music. And so it's always there. It's always evolving. And thank God.
That's Bo Leibowitz, jazz DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Bo, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
I gotta be near you, baby, yeah. Just a minute of you.
The mother of a kindergartner in West Virginia is suing the Mercer County Public School System, asking they end the 75-year-old practice of teaching a Bible studies class. The Bible in the Schools program is active in 15 elementary schools, 1 intermediate, and 3 middle schools in Mercer County, West Virginia. The lawsuit plaintiff, known as Jane Doe, along with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, contend the classes are unconstitutional. Annie Laurie Gaylor is co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. They're based in Wisconsin. And she joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio. Annie Laurie, welcome, and start by laying out the basis of your lawsuit.
We were contacted by Jane Doe, who became aware that when her kindergartner was going to get into first grade, the kindergartner was going to be presented with a Bible study class for half an hour every week, right through elementary school and into middle school, that is simply evangelical, fundamentalist, Christian Bible indoctrination, and there is a very clear Supreme Court precedent against any kind of indoctrination like this in our public schools, but specifically dating to 65 years ago, the McCollum versus Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court protecting children from this kind of predatory indoctrinational conduct by a public school.
Well, that's the case of Vashti McCollum, an atheist who objected to voluntary religious classes during school time in public schools in Champaign, Illinois. Her son James, she says, was ostracized for not attending them. So a couple things here. First of all, you've been calling it indoctrination. Of course, they disagree in Mercer County. They say it's a, you know, a class about learning about the Bible. But there is an opt-out. The child of your plaintiff can opt not to go to this class.
First of all, the school should not be doing anything that kids have to opt out of in order to protect their freedom of conscience under the First Amendment. Even if kids are Christian, they're being indoctrinated by a public school paid for by all tax dollars to all taxpayers. And this is inappropriate. We are a secular nation, and our schools are supposed to be secular, and religion doesn't have any part of the school day. But in terms of the consequences to Jane Doe and Jane Doe's child, anyone who doesn't take these classes is going to stand out like a sore thumb, because almost all the kids take it. And we know what happened with the McCollum case in Champaign, Illinois, where Jim McCollum actually had to leave town to get away from the harassment. It was ruining his young life. And we know from another case we took in Dayton, Tennessee, a similar Bible instruction class, we had to protect the identity of the children because they wanted to run the family out of town.
These courses in Mercer County have been questioned before. Between 1939 and 1985, these classes were completely financed and administered by citizens there. And parents complained in 1985. Parents of 8 students filed complaints with the State Education Department. And after that complaint, the classes were taken over by the county schools. The Mercer County Board of Ed said they're now funded by a nonprofit. They're taught by itinerant teachers, in other words, teachers from outside the school, and the school board must approve the curriculum. Doesn't that make it at least a little bit better that it's not just ordinary citizens coming in and running a Bible class?
No, they're itinerant Bible teachers. They're supposed to have a degree in the Bible. They're not regular school teachers. This is not an objective course. It's all about indoctrinating children. So they're given lessons in the Ten Commandments and why they shall have no other God before them. They're given lessons in worshiping Jesus, basically, and harmonizing the four Gospels and the last days of Jesus' life. There's a creationist lesson, which is really ridiculous, in lesson two, where children are taught to imagine Adam and Eve and how lucky they were that they got to use dinosaurs like water slides. This is not education. This is miseducation.
Well, and of course, just to be clear, the first humans would not have existed alongside the dinosaurs because there was such an extraordinary amount of time between them.
Absolutely. This is anti-teaching evolution in the schools.
Yeah. Look, playing devil's advocate, won't Jamie Doe be ostracized if the lawsuit is successful and the Bible program is removed? 75 years, these children, their parents have all had this same course. It's a community that seems to cherish its Bible classes for its kids.
We are getting a protective order for Jane Doe and Jane Doe's child, so their identity cannot be divulged. So that should protect them. But we still have separation of state and church in this country. We have public secular schools. And what's really also being violated here, not just the rights of Jane Doe, but the First Amendment itself. And we don't want our children in any place, whether it's Mercer County, West Virginia, or Madison, Wisconsin, or anywhere, being taught, mistaught, being taught that there were dinosaurs and Adam and Eve, that our schools are supposed to promote Christianity. What does that say to Jews and the non-religious, who are now a quarter of our population, and other non-Christians? We are not a Christian nation. So this is why it's terribly important to defend this.
That's Annie Laurie Gaylor, co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Annie Laurie, thank you.
Well, thank you.
And the Mercer County schools tell us they will not be speaking with the media about the lawsuit until they can review it with their board and their council. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.